Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, where our job is to help you build visibility, professional credibility, and connection with your ideal client by putting the human at the center of innovative marketing, so you can build and strengthen an engaging, enduring relationship with your ideal clients. I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm honored that you're here with me. If you haven't joined our wonderful marketing transformation community yet, go to innovabiz.co and collect your free gift as well. Do subscribe to the show and also leave a review because it helps others find us. Let's get into today's masterclass on this InnovaBuzz podcast.
If you're in the innovation sphere and you want to be doing different things, get good at the things that you want to do. I'm a true believer in that you're not born an entrepreneur, you're born a coffee guy, or you're born a public speaking guy, or you're born a coach. You just use those tools that you have to become an entrepreneur in that space. And so there's no point trying to sell something that you're not good at or that you have no idea about. I just don't think you can do it. And so invest in yourself, and especially at this current time where there might not be a lot of work going around, there are so many resources online, and give yourself space to make mistakes and to fail and get back up and have another crack and enjoy it while you're doing it.
Welcome back. I hope you've had an awesome week so far. If you haven't listened yet to my recent conversations with marketing coach Charlie Wyman and with copywriter Hayley Green, then check them out after you've listened to today's conversation. I'm really excited to have on the InnovaBuzz podcast as my guest today, Sam Keck, who is an entrepreneur and founder of Common Folk Coffee, located in the town of Mornington on the Mornington Peninsula, south of Melbourne. Sam has spun a successful roaster retailer into a series of social enterprise efforts, including Zukuka Bora, a farmers' initiative benefiting coffee growers in Uganda, and Homeground, which is focused on providing training and job options in hospitality to unemployed youth on the Mornington Peninsula in his local area. By fusing the high demand for quality coffee with organized social enterprise, Sam's work shows us how coffee can do more than just taste good, and it certainly does taste good. It can also do very serious good for communities, both at home and around the world. Indeed, it's a wonderful model for how business in general can be a force for good in the world. In our discussion today, Sam talked to me about the importance of a pioneering mindset and innovation, how to leverage technology in your business in a way that frees your time for relationship building, and being flexible and pivoting your business in difficult times. Without further ado then, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Sam Keck. Hi, I'm your host, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited to welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast today from Mornington near Melbourne in Australia, Sam Keck, who's the Executive Director at Common Folk Coffee Company. Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, Sam. It's a real privilege to have you here as my guest.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here.
Andrew Vanderbeek, who was our guest on episode 242 of the InnovaBuzz podcast, he suggested that we have a conversation with you, Sam, and introduced us. So big hello to Andrew.
G'day, Andy. How you going?
Now, Common Folk Coffee. So just to set the scene a little bit, it's you started off as a small cafe down on the Mornington Peninsula, which is kind of a little bit of a day trip resortish area outside of Melbourne for those people that don't know it, and you've since grown that to a successful roaster, retailer, wholesaler, and you're also doing some quite amazing work supporting farmers in the third world, some of the coffee growers, and also doing some work with a local social enterprise where you support unemployed youth and provide opportunities for them. So I think there's a lot to explore today that's beyond just coffee, but of course, as a great coffee fan myself, I'm really keen to explore some of that as well. Absolutely. So before we get into all of that, tell us a little bit about your background, you know, whistle stop tour of how you got to where you are today and why coffee.
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's a bit of a winding path, so I'll keep it relatively brief. But coffee was never in my plans when I was at high school or even at university. I actually wanted to study and did study and finish a bachelor in zoology and ecology. So my plan was to be the next David Attenborough and to fly around the world filming nature documentaries and focusing on conservation and general public awareness around the issues facing our climate and ecological systems of the planet. And I loved every minute of it. But funnily enough, while I was at uni, like many other uni students, I needed a part-time job to kind of, you know, pay for my, you know, habits and my rent and my food and everything else. And I was lucky enough to get a job as a barista. And when I started, I had no idea what I thought there was a button on a coffee machine that just you pressed it and it made a cappuccino. So just for everyone out there who's playing, there is no button on a coffee machine that you press and it makes a cappuccino. It's a much more manual process, but I quickly fell in love with coffee. And it happened to coincide with a real renaissance in sort of the third wave or the specialty coffee movement, in particular in Melbourne. And so while I was studying at Melbourne Uni, I was lucky enough to sort of get employment at some of the really great coffee roasters who were sort of starting this new movement, who were focusing on not just coffee as a commodity or coffee as a drink that wakes you up in the morning, but coffee as a luxury product, coffee that should be celebrated in and of its own right, in the same way that you might drink a fine wine from a particular region for the enjoyment of it and not just to get drunk, or in the same way that you might choose to, you know, kind of partake in any luxury product beyond just the fact that you needed clothing or you needed something to eat or something to drink. And that's sort of what led me to want to do my own thing. And so I graduated uni in 2009 and pretty much immediately decided to work full-time in hospitality and coffee, mostly to see if I could hack it. Because for anyone who's not worked in hospitality or in retail, it's not the easiest or the highest paying of industries. There's a lot of work and not a lot of thanks. I always tell people that probably the first thing they should come to terms with is that for every coffee you make a customer, you have to clean up about two coffees worth of mess. So it's a lot more cleaning than it is making coffee. But I just wanted to see if I was sort of on board with that. When I realized that, yeah, it was indeed something I wanted to do, the next step was, yeah, trying to put together a business plan to open up what would be the first roaster of its kind on the peninsula in my region. Try and figure out how to run a business, because as I said, I'd studied science, I hadn't studied economics, I hadn't studied business, and I still have no formal degree in either of those things. So that's sort of my journey towards coffee.
That's fascinating. Yeah, well, certainly probably your timing was really good, because as you say, there was a big renaissance in the early 2000s of specialty coffees in Melbourne, and certainly now if you go down the laneways in Melbourne, there's a plethora of coffees. I mean, you could kind of get your caffeine high simply by, you know, 2 minute walk.
For sure.
It's interesting. You said you had no business background at all or business knowledge when you started the business. So how did you go about, first of all, how did you go about developing that business plan without kind of any business background? And then after that, how did you kind of acquire more business skills to run the business?
Great questions. And I think the first thing that I would say was that running a good business doesn't absolutely require formal training in business, but I think that if you don't have it, you need to sort of broaden your network to include people who can mentor you and kind of assist you in that. So when I started Common Folk, I did it with three other guys. So a good friend of mine, Duncan Brown, and he introduced me to who are now really good friends of mine, Ben Hogan and Andrew Dell, all three of whom had varying experience in business, whether it was large corporate, whether it was small business, none of them in coffee or hospitality, but we're all really passionate about fine food and obviously fine coffee. And so with a lot of their assistance, we managed to put together, or at least I should say, fix the business plan I'd initially come up with to make it a bit more reflective of what we could expect to do. And so Duncan's background, he was actually the pastor of a church at the time, so not exactly business, but his father's actually a property developer and a farmer. And so he had a lot of understanding of the way that big corporations might run. Ben Hogan was actually working at the time in aviation. And so he was an engineer and had a lot of understanding around, again, process and procedure, which was key. And Andy Dell, who's actually a personal trainer, had run during his life jewelry stores, surfwear stores, and other smaller businesses. And so he had a real understanding of how that small retail space can operate, because counter to what the other guys were used to, what we were doing was really small and needed to be quite flexible. And so at the time, I don't think we realized how much of our, I guess, diverse backgrounds were bringing strength to what we were doing, and that each of us was playing a key role, because we were just trying to fit out this warehouse that we'd taken a lease out on. And it was easy to neglect the insight each of us was bringing early days, when it was really just blood, sweat and tears. Get in, make sure that we get everything built before our lease kicks in too expensive and we can't serve customers and we've got an empty warehouse. So, you know, it was sort of over that first year to 2 years when we realized what we put together was putting us in good stead, I guess, to compete and out-compete in our arena, especially on the peninsula where we were.
So how did you come up with kind of a vision? What was the vision that you came up with, and how did you kind of keep that alive when you started employing people, employing staff, and when you were getting into the times where there were challenges, to keep that alive as well?
Yeah, I think, so as I said before, I fell in love with coffee through with the whole of Melbourne, I guess, at the same time as the whole coffee community was falling back in love with coffee. And I think that initially I was a coffee guy, so I was obsessed with the perfect extraction, the provenance of the beans, and just doing the best I possibly can. And so that was sort of my driver, but that didn't really translate into a business. That's just some guy who's obsessed with coffee. And so I guess the next step was me looking around, especially where I grew up on the peninsula, because I was a local guy down here, and before I moved to Melbourne for study. And I always wanted to come back down, because the peninsula, for those who aren't familiar with it, it's a region very much famous for its wineries and its fine dining. It's a holiday destination. I think almost half of our population is in some way working in or around tourism. And so it's a huge driver for our economy. And yet, well, here we are, literally 50 minutes drive from Melbourne, the world's greatest coffee city. And there was no specialty coffee roaster. There was no sort of pride taken in that part of the hospitality industry. And I just figured there's a huge hole there to be filled. And it can be filled with the product that I love. And so that was probably the first conceptualized sort of idea I have, is to just produce really, really high quality coffee and roast it, because I'm sure that there's going to be people who want to drink it. And that pretty quickly morphed into something a lot bigger. Now, we sort of had three business plans. One was a conservative worst case scenario. One was what we expected to happen. And one was an ambitious, you know, pipe dream business plan, so that we, you know, we knew what moves we had to make. And I think that we totally undersold how desperate the people of the peninsula were for freshly roasted specialty coffee, because after the first month of trade, we doubled our most ambitious business plan. So we basically threw them all out and had to start from scratch again, which is the best problem to have, I guess, if you're starting a business. Yeah, The idea really being that we were going to search for coffee, but it was going to be accessible, and that unlike some of the big specialty brands you might encounter in a major city, we weren't going to make it exclusive. And although we absolutely believed what we were serving was the finest of its class in the world, that we wouldn't treat it like, you know, another luxury brand might treat its product and make it exclusive. Instead, I mean, we named our business Common Folk. The idea was that great coffee was for every folk, it was for everybody. And so we kind of put together a bit of a manifesto around what that would look like. So we focused first and foremost on quality. And for us, quality wasn't just, does it taste great? It was also, is it great for the world that this exists? Are the people producing it also benefiting from it? Are the people drinking it also assisting us to be, you know, to be better and getting something that's just a little bit special? It was also a community because we had opened up a retail venue as well as the roastery. As you said, we have sort of a cafe attached to what we do. We really felt like to make this accessible, excellent product accessible, we've got to open it up to everyone. And so really building on how we can be a positive impact in our community was huge. And so from the get-go, we tried to find ways that we could work with different local clubs and schools and sponsorships and that kind of thing to kind of, you know, win over the people who'd be drinking our coffee. And then the final sort of two values that we have in our manifesto were pioneering. So we realized that we were the first of our kind in our region, but we didn't want to rest on our laurels and go, well, because we were the first to do it, that's all we need to do. And so interestingly, you know, in an innovation podcast, I feel like pioneering and innovating are pretty much hand in hand. And so it's actually one of our mantras that we are always sort of reassessing. How can we be ahead of the next thing in coffee? Or even not in coffee, how can we be ahead of just the next thing? And how can common folk work within that? And the final one, which is super important to myself and my business partners, and inadvertently now our team, is integrity, is that we are who we say we are. We do what we say we do. And that I think one of the lines at the end of our sort of manifesto says that we do good stuff and we develop new ideas and we partner with new people, but we make sure we do it so that, you know, we feel the best and others don't feel the worst, because we're not out there to try and cut someone else's lunch, and we certainly don't want to exploit people. And I think in particular, when you're dealing with a commodity like coffee, the big risk is that, you know, those who innovate the most and those who have, I guess, the most privilege or the most access to resource can inevitably win the entire game at the total expense of all others involved. And that generally happens with third world producers and farmers. And for us, it just wasn't going to cut it. We weren't going to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. I love the whole manifesto thing. And so with the growth of the business and as you started to grow your team, how big's the team right now anyway?
So we've got, I guess we've started calling ourselves the Common Folk Group. And so we have a number of entities that operate within us. So we've got the hospitality side of things that includes the cafe and our functions and events team. We've got our wholesale roasting, which includes the Common Folk brand as well as some contract roasters that we do. And we also have branched out into Common Folk beverages, which includes things like pre-brewed cold brew coffee and that kind of thing that we might stock in retail spaces. And so between those groups, we've got between 35 to 40 people sort of in our employ and about 20 full-time employees. Obviously with the coronavirus restrictions, that was drastically impacted, but thankfully we've been a long-standing business. Even with our casual staff, most of them have been eligible for the JobKeeper payments. So right now I can say that we've welcomed back the majority of the team, which is really good. Some on restricted hours, but yeah, so the team still stands at around similar numbers, and our plan is to keep growing, keep adding strings to our bow. Yeah, we've got no intention for this to be, you know, the biggest and the best Common Folk ever gets. We certainly want to get bigger. So,
yeah. So you talk about building a great culture, and that, you know, I think you said something like strong coffee is good, but a strong culture is just as important for your business. So how do you go about, you know, keeping that vision, that mission that you outlined for us alive with new people, and how do you build that into an integral part of your culture?
It's really bloody hard. It's really hard, I think, to keep a strong culture and to sort of, you know, to grow on what you initially planned for a business and to welcome other people into that. And then inevitably you have to let them drive the culture and sort of be your ambassadors, because I don't direct, you know, the 40 crew that work for me don't directly report to me, nor should they. And so I think we definitely haven't got it right from the start. I'd say early on, a lot of it fell onto my shoulders. So I was definitely one of the one of those classic, I guess, small business owners who felt that if I wanted a job done properly, I needed to do it myself. And that's why I think a lot of small businesses don't grow, but also why a lot of small business owners burn out. And so early days, I fought tooth and nail to try and insist that the culture be maintained across the rest of the team. And thankfully, and to the team's credit, it did. But probably because a lot of my influence was there. So I was genuinely working in every department of the business, from roasting through to distribution, through to the cafe, even in the kitchen on the machine. And so the culture was strong, but if I stepped out of that, we risked losing a lot of what we had. I think that it was probably a couple of years in when we noticed that our growth was really pulling me this way and that, and that there was no way I could be the leader in each of the departments. I guess we went down our first pathway of putting managers into each area. And that's probably where I started making the biggest mistakes that I'd made. Now, interestingly enough, I don't think that I employed the wrong managers, but it was probably more assuming that somehow they could just come in and do exactly what I wanted them to do and act exactly the way I wanted them to act without sort of any further guidance and instruction. And so there was probably a couple of years of reassessing my micromanagement and how much I was sort of, letting my managers do and how much faith and trust I put in them. But at the same time, how I trained them up and built them up as people and professionals. Because in our industry, especially the hospitality part of it, unfortunately, it's just an unskilled and unprofessional industry as a general rule. Now, at Common Folk, we're really lucky because of the hard work we've put in to attract really professional people and to train people up to be more professional. But you're dealing with a pool of people, many of whom have never been given an employment contract, let alone just, you know, like had a position description for the role they're performing. And so probably between year two and I would say sort of year four of our operations, we spend a lot of time refining our position descriptions, our policies and processes, and the way that we implemented those, to the point where we opened up a second venue, which we've now sold. And it was quite successful, but that we had managers in place, head chefs in place, director of coffee from a wholesale perspective, but all of whom understood our manifesto, held true to those four values that I described, and really understood what it meant to be a folker, which is what we call our team and our fans. And we built on that. And rather than, I guess, myself trying to take all the glory, but also all the work, really, really pushed to allow others to make mistakes and to grow and to develop the culture for themselves, knowing that, sure, that it could have been quicker if I did it myself, or maybe I would have got it exactly the way I wanted it, but that it would limit what we could do in the long term. And it's, yeah, like I said earlier, it's a very hospitality-centric sort of issue, but it probably translates into a lot of businesses. But in particular, you know, it was really important to empower these guys who had probably never been empowered before and say, you know what, you're in charge of this thing. Go for it. You know who we are as a business. You know where we're heading. I'm here to hold your hand and to help you, not to berate you and tell you you've done it all wrong. And I think it's worked because we're about 8 years in now. And I would say that in terms of churn, staff turnover, it's pretty typical for maybe a hospo staff member to last 12 months in a role. And I've got guys who started with me when they were 15 washing dishes who are now senior members of the team. So probably the best story is we had this one lady who worked for me from day one as sort of a sandwich maker, who's now our venue manager. And there was a point where I thought I was going to terminate her employment. And in fact, we joke about the story all the time because she was not rocking up on time and didn't follow any of the process and procedures. She actually went away and managed a couple of other locations before returning to Common Folk. And we kind of have an ongoing joke with all of our staff saying all roads lead back to Common Folk. So once you've become a Common Folker, you might go work somewhere else, but inevitably you're going to come and work for us again because we're a great place to be and we're a family. And yeah, we really love our people and stand by them.
Mm. Yeah, I think there's a lot of really good lessons in that go well beyond just the hospitality industry or coffee industry there. And I think you've probably touched on quite a number of challenges that are fairly common for any business that's in the early stages and rapid growth too.
Yeah.
Mm. So as we're recording this, you touched on the COVID situation before. As we're recording this, we're kind of right, well, who knows if it's right in the middle, but we're right in the thick of it, put it that way. So by the time it airs, who knows where we'll be? Maybe it'll be history, maybe not. But how have you pivoted as a result of the lockdown and the, I'm guessing that you've had to close the cafe to the public?
Yep. Mm. Yeah, I mean, when it first all hit, it really came out of left field. Like, I think if anyone had been told at the start of 2020 that we'd be, you know, living in a police state and wouldn't be allowed to leave our homes, you would have just laughed at them. But, you know, it's where we find ourselves. And I think that, thankfully, because of the structure and I guess the understanding of our team, you know, really getting around each other and having that pioneering value, when it all happened, the first thing most of my team did was sort of turn around to me and go, okay, so what are we going to do about this? Rather than going, this is terrible. You know, I've lost my job. Oh, what am I going to do? We did initially have to stand down a lot of our team. Most of our casual workforce, unfortunately, we just couldn't afford to employ because, as you said, rightfully so, we had to shut down the cafe side of it. Luckily, we're still able to do takeaways, but we're operating in a sort of an industrial zone and our venue is very much set up for people to be able to maybe spend a little bit of time in. So we've continued to do takeaway, but business has been impacted. Oh, we've probably dropped 70 to 80% from a cafe perspective. And so that's really difficult. But to counter that, we've really invested in remote ordering technology. So we're probably one of the first businesses on the peninsula, cafes, I should say, because a lot of takeaway joints do this anyway, but to implement a drive-up and a pick-up ordering option. So our customers can now order their coffee and set the time that they want to pick it up on their phones. And if they put in their car rego, we'll even run it out to them out the front. So it's totally contactless. And that's proven to be a godsend. So we've been able to service a lot of people who have been actually self-isolating and not leaving their house at all because we can literally drop it to their cars. And on the flip side, and this is probably where it helps us being so diverse in the business offerings, we've been able to sell a lot of retail coffee for people to make at home. So we sell coffee equipment like plungers, AeroPress, pour-overs, batch brew machines. Pretty much you want it, we've got it. And a lot of our customers love the opportunity to buy freshly roasted coffee. And so the pivot there has probably been more free local delivery. So I've got a team of full-timers that we were doing our best to find, you know, meaningful employment for during this period. And so part of it was making sure we had cash flow. And then the other part of that was making sure that, you know, it was things that we could actually do and be profitable doing. And so dropping coffee beans off at locals' houses proved to be probably the greatest deviation or lane change we could have imagined. So we went overnight from retail being maybe 10% of our wholesale offering to being over 50% overnight. And we had, I guess, what you'd call panic coffee buying in that first week, where we actually ended up doing more that week, that first week of March when they put the restrictions on, than we had the week prior in orders. But it was all coffee beans for home delivery. And obviously things have slowed off a little bit now. That certainly helped us. And I think it was just us being ready to do that. And it's forced us to, I don't want to answer too many questions you ask later, but sort of invest in, I think, in innovative solutions to those issues. So we've really rethought and redesigned the way that we process online orders. So previously, you know, we might do, you know, in the tens of orders a week, whereas now we'd be doing in the hundreds to almost the thousands of individual orders. And so having a system that can process that online has been really key. And so, you know, we'd just invest in whatever the best fintech is at the time that kind of deals with that solution. And we've got a team that's motivated and capable of doing that. And so it's meant that this transition away from, I guess, bricks and mortar retail and into the digital space has been not pain-free, but more painless than I anticipated or would have anticipated if you told me we'd be doing this months ago. And I guess the other thing we've done, which is, I'm not sure if we'll continue with, but it's just been from a cafe perspective, offering home delivery of sort of your more grocery style things. So we've done gift boxes and packs. We may continue to do that, but it is a big deviation from what we normally do. And we're not Coles or Woolworths, so it's a little bit more difficult for us to offer value in that sphere, you know.
Yeah, well, it certainly highlights that, you know, there are opportunities, even if you've got a bricks and mortar store where you've been forced to actually shut your doors right now, that there are opportunities to still do business through various things and still serve your customers and add value, because everybody's hurting. Everybody's, like, as you say, you know, people are in quarantine or lockdown. So the ability to have somebody pre-order a coffee, drive by, have somebody drop it there, and it's all contactless. That's huge value in that, apart from the fact that, you know, you still get a nice coffee rather than having to resort to, God forbid, Nescafe at home.
And I think I might touch on that a little bit more in the event that there may be either people in the fintech space listening to this or other hospitality people, is that there's a big discrepancy between the sort of applications and the technology available and then the actual practical use of that in my industry. And I think that there are literally thousands and thousands of businesses who should be utilizing this sort of technology who aren't, simply because they're either illiterate in it or the technology has been created by someone in fintech and not someone in hospitality. And although, as I was saying, opportunities to implement sort of these ordering platforms for, you know, pickup and takeaway seem really obvious, I think there's a bit of a discrepancy between the apps and the technology available from the fintech sphere that can kind of assist hospitality, and then hospitality owners and managers' abilities to implement that. And I think that there's a lot of apps that do a really good thing, but in application, practically, they're not great because they were built by people in fintech rather than hospitality people. And on the flip side, there's a lot of hospitality people who just don't know that there's these sort of things available. And if they were given them, they wouldn't actually know how to implement them. And so when we implemented this system, it was on the shoulders, I guess, of giants with a lot of sort of understanding and expertise assisting us to get it done well. And a lot of testing and a lot of sort of very quick testing, I should say, because we did this in a matter of a week to get it going. And it's easier said than done. And so I think, you know, my encouragement is to people in hospitality to ask the right questions, go to your accountants and go to your advisors and find out who they know or what they know that can provide assistance in this sphere. Don't just assume that you can Google it and just go with the first multinational company that pops up. Because there's going to be a much more boutique solution. And I guess that's something that I'm really, really passionate about, because as I say to a lot of our wholesale customers, your success is my success. The more coffee you sell, the more coffee I sell. And so I've noticed in my sort of 7 years of running this business that there are really the haves and the have-nots. And it's not necessarily those with a lot of capital or those who are running, you know, a huge 200-seater venue. It's more those who are prepared to go the extra mile and to think creatively and outside of the sphere, who end up selling an extra 10, 15 kilos of coffee a week. And that's often the wage that the owner's going to take home. And so it's a difficult industry, but you've got to look outside of the box, I think, to make it work. And it goes from on both ways, from both the technological side of things just and back to the actual hospitality operator.
Mm. Yeah, and that's a great point that you make there also in terms of getting advice from as many people as you can in terms of what else is out there that, particularly in the area of technology, that isn't everybody's cup of tea or coffee. But you know, there may well be solutions out there, and as you say, boutique solutions that might be particularly adaptable to a specific situation that can help you pivot your business in tough times or open up new opportunities. So yeah, that's really something well worth considering.
Definitely.
Okay, now we touched early on that, you know, you've done other things around the business in terms of helping communities, helping the coffee suppliers. So you've got the Cup That Counts initiative, which is a really interesting one. So talk us through that one a little bit, because I think there's so much really, really wonderful there, and a lesson for all businesses where, you know, how can you do good for society or your communities that you're involved in?
Yeah, so I think it's probably fairly common knowledge, even with just your general coffee consumer, that this industry is full of exploitation. That's why we've got certifications like Fair Trade and the like. And so I think there's a general understanding that not all coffee is equal. But what I don't think people really understand is just how big a negative impact the coffee commodity market can and does have on those people who are primary producers and working, you know, at the coalface. And so when we started the business, I realized that not only from a producing point of view, but also from a hospitality point of view, we were really working closely with some of the most vulnerable people in Australia, which is your minimum wage hospitality, unskilled workers. And then from a global perspective, the primary producers in coffee. And so we wanted to set up an initiative that would contribute towards creating a fair and sustainable industry for everyone involved. That was sort of the mantra behind the Cup That Counts. And so initially, I think we were talking about donating 10% of profits. And I'm really glad that we moved away from that model. That was sort of, I think, suggested first by Andy Dell, one of my business partners, was to not give away profits, but to actually give away an actual fixed amount for a product that we order. So the reason why I didn't want to give away profits is because there's a lot of other charities that say we're not for profit and all profits raised go towards this initiative. And they never make profits because they're not a profitable business. They're not run well. They don't do what they say they do. They just look good. And then the guy who's running it takes home his six-figure paycheck and laughing all the way to the bank that has no money in it. And so we decided that from day one, we would commit 20 cents from every single coffee we've sold, rain, hail, or shine, towards the Cup accounts. So that if we weren't profitable, it didn't matter. That money was leaving our account and we were going to contribute it. And so we've done that since, I guess, day dot with Common Folk. And I think to date, we've raised over $200,000 towards this initiative. And that's been spent on a number of things. Partly it's been to help set up Zakukabura Coffee Company, who is now one of our biggest coffee suppliers, who didn't exist before our generous customers and the guys at Common Folk invested in, you know, I guess, their idea, which was to do specialty coffee in and around Mount Elgon in Uganda. And so we buy a shipping container of coffee from them every year now. And then the other thing that we've really invested in has been the Home Ground Initiative, which is about supporting and training young sort of like locals who don't really have a skill or maybe come from a bit of a tough background in a not-for-profit in a impoverished community in our local area called Tantai. And sort of that's been the other side of the equation. And through those things, I think we've managed to see varying, I guess, degrees of impact, but nothing greater than what we've done in Uganda. We went and visited in November last year. I took over our head roaster and Andy, one of my partners. This gentleman who wasn't employed by Zakukabura Coffee Company, which is the company we've helped fund, he was actually a subcontractor to them to build raised drying beds for coffee. And through the money he earned doing that, he built a cafe in a community that had no retail business whatsoever out of his own money. So it's not even the direct impact of the money, it's the flow-on effect. And now the community had this space where they'd all collectively meet and drink coffee, which they previously didn't really do, didn't drink a lot of coffee because it was too expensive and they needed to sell it. Whereas now they were producing a lot of it themselves. And I guess what they communicated to us was that they saw us as being, you know, business partners as opposed to coffee buyers. And I guess that's really humbling to us because we haven't done any of the hard work. All we've done is sent over some funds. But then really special because now I can take those stories and those photos and those videos and show them to our customers who, you know, if they hadn't supported us and purchased coffee, we would have donated no money. And so I guess the people of the Mornington Peninsula have almost done a world first, which is totally funded a coffee company in another country. So I guess it's the first regionally funded coffee producers in the world, as far as I'm concerned, which is really cool.
That is neat, yeah. And yeah, it's interesting that you decided to go with that model of just 20 cents off each cup of coffee, and you didn't increase the price, right? My understanding is that your cup of coffee price is pretty much standard, so it's not that
it's actually probably lower than some others.
So yeah, people aren't paying a premium, but they certainly have the sense that they're also contributing. And I love the so we'll post a link to your website and we'll talk about that later, where you have a video of, I'm guessing that was that visit, but certainly it's certainly very touching because it's one of the young children whose father is one of the growers talking about the impact that it's had on his life, which I think, you know, that's really touching. But the interesting thing is it doesn't take a lot of effort or take a lot of huge financial success or financial commitment to do something good like that, that contributes back. And in this case, you know, it's contributing back to your own supply chain. So you're actually, you've actually got access to a container load of really top quality coffee each year that sets you apart again, because that's the only place I'm guessing that you probably get that coffee. But at the same time, you're also contributing to other people's, making other people's lives much better.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that's the beautiful thing, is that, like you said, we didn't know whether this initiative would take off. We didn't know if their company would be successful in producing enough coffee or high enough quality coffee to export to ourselves. But each year they've improved, and the coffee is, it's a stalwart of what we offer, and our customers look forward to it every year. In fact, we're about to take possession of the biggest container load of it that we've ordered to date in a couple of weeks, which has presented a whole heap of other issues, because paying for that coffee was normally quite easy because we knew how much it would be going through, whereas now we've got a shipping container of coffee that we're probably not going to sell for maybe a significant period of time. And so we've been lucky enough to be able to take advantage of the government-backed loans through our banks. And so we're taking possession of that coffee, and we'll use that supplier loan to pay it out, because now the issue being that we've funded this project and we've built it to this point, but if we pull out now because we don't have the funds to buy the coffee, it was all for naught, because those people are so vulnerable, they can't afford to miss out on one season's worth of income. And so we've committed to it regardless. And I know that, I mean, the exciting thing is that now it's going to make up a huge portion of what we sell. And so customers are going to be able to order that coffee, hopefully before the end of May. It'll be in our roastery and getting roasted, ready to fill the cups of the coffee drinking public.
Great. Well, we'll put some links in the show notes where people can maybe order some of that.
Be great.
Great. So one of the things I was going to ask you, had, because I know you have a wholesale business as well, and the wholesale and also the retail business you mentioned on online, where you're selling the coffee beans right around the country, or perhaps even internationally. How do you market yourself in those spaces?
It's a great question. I think initially we really pushed to local. As I said, there was no one really like us down here when we opened. And so we had a lot of organic sort of, I guess, you know, like an organic evolution from being like the local roaster to being in some of the better local venues. I think now very much I'm a big believer in all publicity is good publicity within reason. So early days, we had a bit of a lesson in taking advantage of that kind of thing. And so we've managed to rustle up a little bit of press, both, you know, locally, nationally, and even internationally, about initiatives and things that we kind of get on board with. And that's been a really great defining way for us to sort of get the brand out there. You've got to have a strong social media presence. You've got to have a strong, I guess, voice and identity. And we're actually going through, or we were going through when all of the Corona sort of stuff kicked in, a rethink and a restructure of our brand, not to expand it, but actually quite the opposite, to really tighten it up and to unify it. We've always seen ourselves as being maybe a little bit edgy and fairly diverse in what we put out there. But I think now, in an effort not to confuse our customers, we're going to kind of tighten up a little bit and really try and lean into what it means to be involved with Common Folk and a Common Folk related brand. Take advantage, or look for opportunities to take advantage of PR and of press and media. Because I think especially when you're dealing with hospitality, and when you're dealing with such an industry where people are essentially only paying attention for a very short period of time, you have to stand out when it's your time in the spotlight. And if you don't do that, you'll fall to the wayside, because so many venues open up with a big buzz, and then 6 months later, there's a full lease sign on the door. So that's been a big priority.
All right. Well, this is fantastic, Sam. It's exciting to hear the story, and also how you've pivoted and what some of the initiatives are that you've still got ongoing, and how you can kind of still support the growers in Uganda, even though, you know, you're obviously suffering some financial hardship as a result of the crisis we're in right now. But that's all great. It's a really wonderful story. I think it's a good point now to move on to the buzz, which is our innovation round. Yep. And it's primarily designed to help the listener learn from your experience. And I've got five questions, and hopefully you'll give us some really insightful answers that'll inspire the listener to go and do something awesome today as a result.
Mm-hmm. Fingers crossed.
So what's the number one thing you think anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
I thought about this long and hard because it's funny, until I was asked to be on the podcast, I never, pioneering is one of our values, but I never thought of myself as an innovator. But I think I've realized that that we certainly are at Common Folk. And I'll try and be industry specific, but I think it's totally translatable. I think the biggest thing for if you want to innovate is to look outside your bubble. Look outside of your industry, look outside of your field, look at what other people are doing. And I'll give you some great examples in coffee and what I've done there. So the specialty coffee industry had that renaissance in the 2000s that kind of got me involved. But I'd say it's plateaued to a certain extent sort of throughout the 2010s, I think primarily because it was focusing inward on itself, thinking that somehow if it looked, you know, at itself through an electron microscope, it was going to uncover this glaring thing that it was missing to improve quality, be better at serving customers, improve hospitality. And the fact is, that's you're not going to discover that in coffee. You know, it's fairly obvious. You buy beans, you roast them, you make sure you're using the highest quality equipment, and you understand all the techniques. But I think that you need to look outside of the industry. And so for me, I've been really looking at the industries that are similar to what we do, but have been around for longer. So fine dining restaurants, from a hospitality point of view, are doing things really well. What trends are they following? How can coffee be involved with that? And probably on a really very specific level, it's the craft wine and beer industries. So those two industries have probably been existing, if not in their current form, but in a similar form for decades before coffee was doing what it was doing. And so I think that what we've found with, in particular, craft beer in Australia is that brands are looking to the consumer, and they're being led by the person drinking the product, not just by the person who's making it. And in coffee, so often the barista sees themselves as the be-all and end-all coffee god. And realistically, baristas, there's no formal training. They probably don't even know what they're talking about. They wouldn't know the difference between, you know, a naturally processed washed Ethiopian yogurt chef and, you know, a Robusta from the Philippines. They just say they know. And you're probably thinking, what are those things? Well, that's a really great question. You probably don't need to know what those things are. As a coffee consumer, you're probably more interested in drinking coffee that you love and that there's a story attached to it. And so that's what I've really been looking at, all the way from branding and packaging through to the way that we process our coffee at origin. So if I'm in Uganda working with our farming partners, rather than just going, you know, go with what you've always been doing, I'll say, we'll invest in this. We'll buy this coffee, even if this experiment turns out poorly, but let's do a different type of fermentation, or let's rename this coffee. Let's not call this coffee, let's not give it a name based on where it's from. Instead, let's give it a name that will excite the customer on our end to drink more of it. And so those sort of things, as simple as they seem, were off limits in coffee, and people weren't comfortable with those sort of ideas for many, many years, because there was sort of a rule book, an unspoken rule book that you had to follow. All the way through to, you know, maybe you've experienced this yourself, Jürgen, if you go into a local cafe and you order your drink extra hot, or you want a shot of vanilla in there or something like that, it's met with the ire of the barista who you've just told him to shoot his own mum. The irony being that if the cafe offers those drinks, surely you're entitled to order them. So I've always told my team, if someone comes in and wants to order an extra hot, extra large, super weak decaf soy latte, make them the best extra hot, extra large, super weak decaf soy latte they've ever had. And after they've bought about 10 of them from you, they'll be open to having a conversation about trying some of the innovative products that we're doing. Another thing about looking outside the industry too is that we try and collaborate with those people too. So, if I can work with a local brewery or a craft wine producer or any sort of relevant industry, I'll try and do it, because coffee is the baby of the hospitality industry, and to think that we know what we're doing is ignorant, to say the least. And so, my advice to anyone really wanting to be an innovator is that there's someone innovating better than you, go find them and copy them. Is that innovation? It's probably not innovation. Translated.
No, I think that's a really good one. I've had quite a few people suggest that in those sort of terms. Look outside your industry, see how people are doing something. Because if it's, you know, if somebody's doing something in the craft beer industry or the wine industry, they probably take it for granted. So that's how we've always done this particular thing. But you look at it and turn it into, well, how can we do that in coffee? And then all of a sudden people say, wow, that's brilliant. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think there's plenty of examples in that where you get that cross-industry thing. And the other thing I like about what you said is that collaborating with those folks, because they're probably in the same boat. They probably look at you and say, oh, you're doing that in coffee. Gee, we could do that in wine or craft beer, and that'd be amazing.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, I guess that's one of the awesome things about what I do. It's just a lot of fun. Like, who doesn't want to muck around with people brewing beer and wine or coffee for that matter? It's probably the best thing about working in industry.
Yeah. The other thing that I was reminded of, you talked about, you know, the coffee with a name that means something more to the customer and that's got a story attached to it. I bought some wine in November, and it was, I'm just trying to remember, I think it was called Lost Ram.
Yeah.
Lost Ram Shiraz. And I was attracted because of the name. And so I looked at it, and there was a story around this ram that had strayed onto this vineyard.
Yeah.
And it kind of, you know, it told the whole story of this ram. It was totally unrelated to the wine, other than it kind of got lost in this vineyard and basically adopted that as its home. But it caused me to try the wine. The wine was actually very good. So I bought it because of the taste, but I possibly would not have tasted it if I hadn't been attracted to the name. So there's all those little things.
It's funny you say that, because I mean, it's an identical story to a coffee we had. And interesting that you said the wine was actually pretty good. I mean, I think that's one of the issues people have, is that a lot of stuff's really good. You know, innovation doesn't necessarily mean that your product's going to be better than someone else's. It just means that the consumer is going to be able to get access to your product ahead of someone else's. And so in our case, we had a coffee from the Zagukabora plantation in Uganda that was naturally processed. Now, if you're interested in finding out what that is, you can Google it, naturally processed coffee. I won't bore you with the details, but as a general rule, Ugandans don't process their coffee that way. And so instead of calling the coffee naturally processed Ugandan from Mount Elgon, and, you know, that's where it was from and that's what you could have called it, we decided to call it the unicorn and come up with a really cool illustration of a unicorn on it. And the story to partner with that coffee was absolutely how we processed it and where we got it from. But the crux was, we named it the unicorn because unicorns don't exist. And quite frankly, this coffee doesn't exist. You cannot get it anywhere else. It shouldn't exist. No one else has produced a coffee like this. So you're essentially drinking a mythical coffee. And of course, people loved it. The coffee itself was delicious, but it wasn't any better than a lot of other coffees we sell. And yet I've still got people coming back to me saying, when are you going to get that back in? When are you going to get that back in? I mean, it's so funny too, because I don't believe that we cheapened the product or that we took away any of the hard work that the farmers contributed towards the product, which is the general, I guess, reason why specialty coffee people don't think outside the box in that way. If anything, we've managed to sell more of the coffee and celebrate the coffee to a greater degree. And so that's my challenge to people in the coffee industry, is like, really take a good hard look at why you're doing the things you're doing, because sometimes you're cutting off your nose to spite your face. And customers, the consumer doesn't know or care. They just want, like you said, the cool story attached to it. And if it's good, they'll come back.
That's right. Yeah. All right. That's great. I love that story. So what's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
So probably touching on what I'd said earlier around PR and sort of good press. Really early on, we had a bit of an incident with one of our neighbors. So when we opened, as I said earlier on, we experienced overnight success in excess to anything we'd planned for, which meant that we're in a bit of an industrial zone, and unfortunately caused all sorts of traffic and parking issues in our local region. And one of our neighbors saw fit to dump a load of horse manure out the front of our business, which was it was confronting for the first 5 minutes until I realized that this is a bit of an opportunity. So we called up the local paper, and they came down and took some photos, and there's hilarious photos of one of my roasters like holding up a whole clump of sort of horse manure, and we put it on the garden, and the garden had never looked better. And And we got a we got an article in the local paper, you know, hard luck story, young small business owner, vandalized by local hooligans or whatever it was. And overnight, our business increased by 20% to that day. I know when the article came out. And so from that point forward, I've been looking for opportunities to get out there, whether it's in a really good, positive way. So I was nominated for what you consider the Oscars of the coffee world. It was a Sprudge Award, the 20 most influential coffee people in the world. And I won that in the first year that was announced last year. It was one other person in Australia and a whole heap of amazing coffee people from around the world. Interestingly enough, it was the head of the project in Uganda who nominated me for it. And I was thinking, you probably should have been nominated for it as well. You're the one in Uganda sort of leading this project. And so there's positive industry-wide recognition through things like that. And on the flip side, there's some fun collaborations. So we partnered with the CSIRO last year. In fact, you may have heard this story. It might jog your memory, but it was around broccoli lattes. So we actually created a product with CSIRO that was going to take advantage of using waste product from broccoli farming that was full of sort of good vitamins and healthy benefits. And of course, they were thinking of putting it in smoothies or making a broccoli flour. But one of their savvy marketing people was like, this is Melbourne. We should make it into a coffee. And so they approached us and I couldn't jump quick enough at that opportunity because I'm like, yeah, I probably isn't going to taste great, but let's turn it into a latte and see what we can do. And I think that's probably the pinnacle of my career was knowing that apparently, and I'm yet to find the article, but apparently Common Folk Coffee was featured in German Playboy magazine because we came up with the broccoli latte. So anyone who's good at speaking Deutsch, go and see if you can find German Playboy and Common Folk Coffee somewhere on the internet. Because apparently,
it exists. Yeah, I'll have to make a note of that because I'll be able to help you with that. Yeah, I'm not sure how it'll look on my search history, though. But
anyway. That's what I was thinking. I've been very careful when I've been trying to find it with no success. Yeah. You never know. My apologies.
All right.
Yeah, come up with anything.
Okay. Now, what's a favorite resource of yours that you use a lot?
I think, again, reaching back to something we'd earlier touched on, fintech and other smart integrations and smart software that just speeds things up. So we're lucky enough to partner with Illuminate and Andrew Vanderbeek, who was the one who dobbed me in for this. And they're fantastic, not because they're good accountants, although they are, but in particular because they're great systems people and they understand, I think, the needs of most businesses, especially small businesses, and they're very, very willing. In fact, they insist on utilizing the resources out there from a digital perspective to make people's lives easier. And so it can be really intimidating for a lot of people in, like I said, hospitality who maybe aren't digitally literate, but find yourself a good accounting partner and or software partner and work through systems that are going to basically shave hours, if not days, off your working week. So if I look at all of the different systems we've implemented from essentially having a till that you whacked in the numbers on and writ down the order when we first opened through to now having fully integrated POS system with our online ordering through to, complicated roasting systems that log every roast we do, all sorts of integrations that kind of automate tasks that shouldn't be repeated, communication systems, like accountability software, stock management. I mean, there's something for everything. And every single one of those programs shaves hours and hours of time and minimizes human error on countless levels. And there's just no way you can grow a business in today's climate without investing in automation and sort of and fintech and digital resource. And so there'll be a boutique solution for everyone's business. But if you're listening to this podcast and you think that doing your books in like a carbon copy notebook is a good idea, you're kidding yourself. Like you just shouldn't be doing it. I get that, old habits die fast, die hard, but you've just got to move with the times and you'll find yourself being able to spend so much time working on your business as opposed to working in your business if you free yourself up by putting in place automation and systems for sure. Mm. It's just a no-brainer for me.
Yeah, and also like freeing yourself up to focus on what you actually do best and also on serving your customers and keep building those relationships with customers, with suppliers, with community that you're doing so much of. All right. Now, what's the best way to keep a project on track?
Great question. I was thinking about this because I'm probably bad. I have too many projects at any given time. As you can probably tell, I'm a little bit manic and I have plenty of ideas, but executing them is a whole other thing. I think there's a few things. You could do it yourself, which we discussed earlier on, isn't always the best idea. But certainly if you're a one-man band, don't expect the work to be done by someone else if it can't be. But on a more realistic level, and for those who are leading teams and trying to get a lot of traction in a sort of a broader, you know, and more diverse range of projects, I think you all need to be aligned from the start. I hate quotes because I think they minimize bigger issues. But, you know, one that's just resonates for me is if you fail to fail to plan, you plan to fail. There you go. Didn't even plan the quote properly. But the fact is, if you measure twice and cut once, it's just going to put you in really good stead to get the project done well and keep it on track. So find people and customers and colleagues who you align with, who understand what the project is and what you want to achieve, have clear mandates around when and how it should be delivered, and go for it. Now, I'm a hypocrite because I don't always do this, but the most successful projects that we've run have inevitably been started in that format. And I think the next thing is work with motivated people. And whether that's the people who are purchasing your product, because I think it's often people are really begrudging of maybe their colleagues or their employees. And that's a really obvious one, because obviously you want your team to be doing a really good job. But sometimes it's the customer who's the problem. If they're expecting you to do all the work, even though a large burden of that needs to fall onto them, or if they think that by aligning with your cool, smart, you know, swanky looking business is going to somehow make their shitty business really good overnight, then they're probably the wrong customer to partner with. And, you know, we've had our fair share of those sort of people. Hospitality is full of people who are struggling and failing. And I always tell people, hey, partner with us because we can certainly help you. But if you're also not prepared to help yourself, and if you're not prepared to implement the things that we suggest, or if you're not prepared to invest where you need to invest, none of this is going to help. Doesn't matter how good Common Folk is, you're not Common Folk. And so finding people who are motivated to actually do the project is huge. And it means sometimes, I think, limiting the people that you choose to sell your product to. I mean, I guess in your space, Jürgen, as a consultant, you've probably met people who you've thought, I can't help this person. You know, they need my help, but they're not going to listen even if I give it to them. And it's, I think it's really difficult to fire a customer. And I'm still learning how to do that. And I like to think that we never have to do that. But I think sometimes to finish a project, it inevitably has to be wound up entirely.
Yeah, I think there's some really good advice in there. And I remember, I can't recall who said this to me, but it was in answer to this question. Mm. And they said, well, if the project's off track, if you're working with the wrong client. Kind of like what you're touching on at the end there. And I guess we've all made the mistake of taking people on that we thought we could help, but for whatever reason, are just not a good match. And that's always going to end in tears or heartache. So it's probably best to clarify that up front.
Yeah. Mm. And it's so hard because I think we're all kidding ourselves if we think that we don't take on clients that ultimately are bad for us, because you're a small business and, you know, you don't say no to an opportunity. I mean, that's part of why you're probably successful and still in small business. And sometimes you can work through those issues and you can find a way to motivate or, you know, I guess get a client to change lanes. But my team actually are very critical of me for this because I try desperately to see the best in everyone and I never want to let something go. But the fact is that there's a point where the amount of effort and resource and time you're putting into something is just not being returned to you. And we're in small business, not, you know, like not friendship with these people, although a lot of them can become your best friends. Ultimately, if they're costing you money, they're not a good business partner. They're not a good client. And that's really difficult. Like I said, I'm learning that lesson every day.
Yeah. All right. Well, what's the number one thing you think anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
Again, I'll draw on my experience in my industry. So I think being honest and practicing what you preach is really key. I think that there's too many ways for people to find out stuff about you these days for you to be able to say one thing and then do another. Someone's going to write a review. Someone's going to write a blog. Someone's going to dig up dirt and prove to you, prove to the public the fraud that you are if you're not legitimate. And so I think that you need to have a plan in place from day dot to be who you really are, and not deviate from that unless you make that public too. And I think that that's fine. It's okay that some people are a low-cost, high-volume commodity product. I don't think there's any issue with that, but don't pretend that you're a luxury, boutique, hard-to-get exclusive product, because eventually it's going to come undone. And so I think that's a big one. I think that being pioneering is really key too. So similar to that first innovation question, looking outside of the industry and looking for ways that you can maybe not fill a gap. I think one thing that annoys me sometimes is that a lot of people who want to be entrepreneurs are looking for something that doesn't exist. They feel like they have to create something totally brand new to be successful. What I usually suggest is the product is only part of what makes any product successful. And so I don't think you necessarily need to create a new product or offer a new solution. It might be that a whole heap of those products aren't marketed well. So, I mean, the perfect example is Andrew and Illuminate with accounting. They're not, I mean, he probably wouldn't mind me saying this, but their accounting is not that much better or different to anyone else's. I mean, obeying tax law and keeping your clients out of jail is just par for the course for accountants. What Andy managed to do was market himself and Illuminate as being, you know, the everyman's accountant and the innovative digital space accountant who, you know, is more likely to go out and get drunk with you at a bar than he is sit down and bore you with the history of tax reform. You know, he looks more like a barista, even though he doesn't drink coffee, than he does, you know, a tax accountant. And so that was actually the pioneering aspect of what he was doing, not the fact that he was a better accountant, although I will say he's an exceptional accountant. And so I think that sometimes to get the edge and to get ahead of people, you're actually better off looking at weak spots in already existing industries and or products, and in particular in your industry and or the product you sell, rather than trying to reinvent something from scratch. Because, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. The world's been spinning for billions of years. And, some people are genuinely inventors, but I think that you've got to differentiate entrepreneurs from inventors. Sometimes they're the same thing. Elon Musk is a great example, but a lot of entrepreneurs are not inventors. They're just really good at taking someone else's idea or a product that already existed and changing it just slightly in some way, shape, or form that meant that consumers all of a sudden saw it differently. And so that's my big advice is don't get tickets on yourself and think that you're going to totally reinvent the wheel. Instead, just look for opportunity. And if you don't see it, you're not looking hard enough.
Okay. Yeah, that's great advice. So, yeah. And certainly the consistency with your values and behavior and so on is a really important message too. And you need to be really clear about what messaging you're sending out. A lot of people are being consistent, but they're not sending out consistent messages. So it's not seen that way from the outside. Mm. All right. Well, thanks, Sam. This has been really great. Now, where can people find out more about Common Folk Coffee and maybe even get in touch to buy some coffee or contribute to your to the coffee cup project or get in touch and say thank you for all that you've shared today?
For sure. So if you want to find out more about us, there's plenty of resources available online, whether it's our website. It's as simple as chucking commonfolk.coffee into your browser and it'll pop up with our website. That has links to our shop, to our takeaway menu and ordering for our cafe, lots of articles and blogs around how we source coffee and who we work with, information on the cup that counts and those partnerships. You could pop into our cafe, albeit takeaway only at the moment, but hopefully by the time this airs, we'll be back on track as a nation with no cases and you'll be able to come in and actually sit down and have a coffee with me. Otherwise, I'm more than happy for people to reach out to me via email. I try and respond in a timely fashion as possible. But very, very keen to engage with anyone who's interested in sort of what we're doing. And I think too, just to broaden your knowledge on coffee and to sort of understand how the mechanics of the industry and why we might be doing what we're doing as opposed to buying from the commodity market. I'm always really passionate about people just, you know, just getting a little bit more insight into the real impact that their daily cup has, because the fact is, I think Australia drinks the second most coffee per capita behind, I think, only Norway. And so we drink a lot of it. So it's probably good to know a little bit about it.
Mm. Yeah. All right. Well, we'll post links to all of that in the show notes and certainly get in touch with Sam to find out more about coffee and the Coffee Cup project and also the Cup That Counts project, and also the being able to order some coffee.
Yep.
All right. Now, what parting advice would you like to leave our listener today?
I'm a big believer. I'm an optimist. And so, you know, I always say search for the silver lining. So for those people whose businesses have been hugely impacted by Corona, like, I'm feeling you. Like, we're going through it ourselves. We're lucky that we've been able to take advantage of a number of the government's programs, but I know not everyone's in that position. Just hold in there. I think that if you need to reinvent yourself, do it. Just get through this. Secondly, to those who are looking to, you know, to expand what they're doing and I guess be good entrepreneurs, my advice is, you know, if you're in the innovation sphere and you want to be doing different things, get good at the things that you want to do. I'm a true believer in that you're not born an entrepreneur, you're born a coffee guy, or you're born, you know, a public speaking guy, or you're born a coach. You just use those tools that you have to become an entrepreneur in that space. And so there's no point trying to sell something that you're not good at or that you have no idea about. I just don't think you can do it. And so invest in yourself, you know, and especially at this current time where there might not be a lot of work going around, there are so many resources online, you know, and give yourself space to make mistakes and to fail and get back up and have another crack, and enjoy it while you're doing it. If you don't enjoy it, I mean, by all means continue, but it's not my advice. Go find something better for you that floats your boat, you know.
Yeah, well, there's lots of good advice in that, and I like what you finished with there. Yeah, if you don't enjoy it, then you might want to have a serious think about change. All right. Finally then, Sam, who would you like me to chat with on a future Innova Buzz podcast, and why?
So there's a young bloke that he actually started off as a barista for one of the wholesale accounts that we sold coffee to, and then wound up doing marketing and digital design and web stuff for not just my business, but also Illuminate and a lot of others. His name's Marcel McCarthy. And funnily enough, he didn't even study it at uni. I think he was studying to be a sound engineer. So maybe a similar story to myself, but the very special thing about what he's managed to do was that he changed lanes and he chased after what people were looking for rather than what he initially thought he'd be doing. And he's really created an incredible, I guess, media agency called 1-2. So that's 1-0 and E 2 being T-double-O. And what they've put together has been, I guess, game-changing for us, but also for a lot of other people, also situated on the Mornington Peninsula, but he's essentially an international brand. So he'll have a lot of interesting insights into not just that space, you know, of kind of media and marketing, but also ways that you can be innovative and reinvent yourself in the face of opportunity. So I reckon you'll probably get more out of him than you will me, I'll say that.
All right. Well, we'll reach out to Marcel. We might get an introduction from you, but we'll certainly look forward to chatting with him on the podcast in the future as well. So thanks so much for sharing your time and your insights with us today so generously, Sam. I've really enjoyed this, and I feel like going and getting a cup of coffee now. yeah, I wish you all the best to the future, and let's stay in touch.
Thanks very much, Jürgen. It's been a pleasure. Really enjoyed it.
Hope you enjoyed that insightful and informative conversation with Sam and took something away from his episode. There are so many valuable lessons from Sam's experience with the coffee business that apply in a fundamental sense to all business, from pioneering mindset and innovation to building community to supporting social causes and engaging your community and more. I'd love to know what you took away from Sam's episode. Leave a comment below the blog post, which you can find at innovabiz.co/Sam Keck. That is SAMKECK. All lowercase, all one word, innovabiz.co/Sam Keck. You'll also find contact information for getting in touch with Sam there, as well as links to the Common Folk Coffee website, his social media pages, and the other resources we spoke about in our conversation today. Sam suggested that we have a conversation with Marcel McCarthy of digital brand and marketing agency 1-2 on a future InnovaBuzz podcast episode. So Marcel, keep an eye on your inbox for an invitation from us to the InnovaBuzz podcast, courtesy of Sam Keck. Finally, I'd like to give a shout out to Jennifer from New York in the USA for her review of the InnovaBuzz podcast recently. She says, "I love this show. The guests are incredible and wide-ranging. So much value in each and every episode. Great for business leaders and entrepreneurs." Thank you, Jennifer. I'm really glad we're adding value to your listening time, and I do appreciate you leaving us a review. Tune in again to the next episodes of the InnovaBuzz podcast. Firstly, our very special episode 300, where George Bryant talks to me about all things modern, human-centered, relationship-focused marketing. And then, to kick off the next 100 episodes, Noah Labhart of Variable and the Code Story podcast. Thanks for listening to this episode. Make sure you subscribe to the show to be reminded of new episodes. It's free to subscribe. Leave a review if you like. Even if you don't like me, I'm okay with that. I'm asking you to leave a review because it helps other people find this show. Go to innovabiz.co to join our marketing transformation community and access a free gift my team and I made for you. It's the Marketing Master Mini Class. We want to give you everything you need to transform your marketing into a human-centered, relationship-focused growth engine. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember, be awesome and keep innovating.